Hello, everyone. It's a very intimate group. It's nice to see you all on a day when the rain has finally left us and the sun is out, and I think that probably impacts attendance all around South by Southwest. I am Mike Gallagher. I'm the CEO of the Entertainment Software Association. I'll explain a little bit more about ESA, but first wanted to thank South by Southwest for giving us the opportunity to be here today. And thank you for being here for the next short while so we can talk about some important issues about our great industry, where it's been recently and where it's going. I just came from GDC out in the West Coast in San Francisco, and I had a similar set of remarks, very similar title to this one, but it was a detailed discussion of the risks and threats that were facing our industry, as opposed to the more optimistic tone of the remarks I get to share with you. And the reason for that is it was a speech to a bunch of lawyers. So for the lawyers in the room, I'm sorry to disappoint you. This will be a much more optimistic outlook on the industry. But we are experiencing, as you can see by the vibrant attendance here at South by Southwest, an unprecedented level of interest in video gameplay, and that serves as a vibrant contributor to our country's economic growth, the education of our children, and the training of the American workforce, and even the health of our people. And today I'd like to highlight these tremendous accomplishments that are going on, these different aspects of the industry, with you. And to be sure, they haven't been achieved without challenge and risk. Most notably, our industry faced a historic challenge last year when there was an appeal to the United States Supreme Court that implicated the First Amendment rights of video game developers and publishers and gamers in the United States. It's a challenge that began in 2005 when Leland Yee, a senator from San Francisco, sponsored the legislation, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, then Governor Schwarzenegger, signed the bill, and it was enacted. We immediately had to go to court and work through that process. So I'll share with you the highlights of that decision, and also how that ruling has created a remarkable opportunity for our industry and for the artists and innovators across many sectors of entertainment to continue moving our society forward in a wide variety of ways. So it's a particularly exciting time for us at the ESA. As many of you know, we're the U.S. Trade Association dedicated to serving the business and public affairs needs of video game publishers on all different devices, whether it's game consoles, personal computers, handheld devices, mobile, and over the internet. And our members include virtually all of the leading entertainment software companies. If you're interested in brand new hardware, the cutting edge of that, we have Microsoft, Nintendo, and Sony as members. If the software and the great games are the focus, we have EA, Ubisoft, Take-Two, Disney, and Warner that fit that description. Those are just examples. And then, of course, if the online, social, and mobile areas of great focus, we have Playdom, Playfish, Nexon, and Trion are also example members that are successful in those spaces. And we represent them on a wide range of issues, from First Amendment advocacy to intellectual property protection, which we'll talk more about. And we work to foster economic conditions that support our robust and growing industry. And we also organize and manage E3, which I think probably most of you in the room are familiar with. And that's the industry's global premier trade show. It's June 5 to 7 in Los Angeles this year. So even before we had to go to battle in the Supreme Court, our members valued ESA's litigation experience. Over the past 8 years, we established a track record of success in overcoming challenges to constitutional protections for video games at both the state and the federal level. Various courts affirmed 13 times over that period that computer and video games are indeed protected speech. They concluded that state legislative efforts to regulate video games based on their content are a violation of the First Amendment. The Supreme Court case was originally filed as Schwarzenegger versus EMA and followed rulings where we won at both the Northern District Court of California and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As some of you may know, the case centered on an ambiguous California law that sought to restrict the sale and rental of violent video games to minors and mandated an additional labeling requirement to be administered by the state. So the state would be in the position or the business of rating games. I recall being in the courtroom on June 27, 2011, when the court upheld the Ninth Circuit's opinion in a 7-2 decision that said video games qualify for First Amendment protection just like books, plays, and movies. The court struck down the California law as unconstitutional, and the decision made clear that any type of content-based restrictions on video games going forward would also be struck down as unconstitutional under the First Amendment. This landmark opinion strongly asserted that video games are protected expression, that their interactive nature makes them more, not less, worthy of that protection, and that the state does not have a free-floating power to censor speech to minors with which it disagrees. The court went on to agree with ESA's position that states cannot circumvent the First Amendment by creating an entirely new category of prohibited speech specific to children. The court found that unlike sexual content, which is regulated, violence has been part of the tradition of children's literature for generations, including Grimm's fairy tales through the Odyssey and Dante's Inferno. The court's ruling was a game changer for the industry. It was a major victory for our industry's developers, publishers, and gamers. Not only did it elevate our industry to the same legal status as books, movies, and fine arts, it also provides a strong defense against future attempts to restrict content that is fully protected under our Constitution. Now, this has an important implications for other media and cultural works as well. Had the court ruled differently, lawmakers would have received the authority to distinguish between acceptable and unacceptable levels of violence in media. It is hardly beyond our imagination that legislators would have attempted to apply these vague standards to other entertainment media and art forms, and this could have put in jeopardy all sorts of classic entertainment that merely because of violent content. Examples could include Mario Puzo's The Godfather, Richard Brooks' In Cold Blood, and Johnny Cash's Folsom City Blues. The court's decision guards against those threats to those industries as well. Now, even in the midst of working on the Supreme Court case, we continued to work on a number of other issues on behalf of the industry in other important areas. For example, we continue to work with parents, retailers, and policymakers to enhance understanding and increase the use of industry-provided resources that help parents make educated game purchase and rental decisions for their families. This includes the ESRB, or Entertainment Software Rating Board, rating system, as well as the parental controls available on all current generation consoles. We're also focusing our energies on other initiatives to support our members and the broader industry. At the federal level, we engage lawmakers on technology policy issues, in particular, including privacy, data security, accessibility by the disabled, and a growing array of e-commerce rules and regulations. We also educate them about the significant economic contributions of our industry and its role in creating an increasing number of high-paying jobs. And in that list that I just read you, I look forward to any questions you might have in the Q&A if the presentation isn't at the level of detail that you would like. In fact, ESA worked with Representatives Kevin Brady from Texas and Debbie Wasserman Schultz from Florida last year to launch the Congressional Caucus for Competitiveness in Entertainment Technology. This bipartisan caucus currently has 56 members and serves as the educational portal to Congress on industry issues, emphasizing the economic and social benefits of sustaining a robust entertainment software industry. And ESA's lead in all matters of government relations and who is a driving impetus and a champion for the establishment of that caucus is Eric Huey, right here, who's seated in the third row. Across all of these programs, ESA seeks to build awareness and understanding of the entertainment software industry's many positive social, economic, and technological contributions. We strive to demonstrate the valuable role video games play in the way businesses operate, students learn, and the American people engage in recreational activity. We maintain a robust anti-piracy program, for example, which protects companies from piracy in both hard goods and in the online environment. Global entertainment piracy is an evolving and growing threat that robs game makers of fair compensation for their originality, ingenuity, and labor. And to address this issue, ESA works with anti-piracy partners across the globe to offer international officials training and intellectual property protection and support for enforcement actions. We're all familiar with the old physical piracy model. Over a few short years, it moved and evolved to embrace peer-to-peer technology, and in an even shorter period of time, to one-click hosts and one-click sites, and which are located predominantly offshore. The threat continues to evolve, and seeing new opportunities in hacking, pirate servers, and user account fraud. These are risks that threaten to undermine every video game business model. But our work with U.S. policymakers stretches beyond intellectual property and copyright measures. We work with government officials at all levels on e-commerce regulations and taxation issues. In the states, we collaborate with officials to foster operating environments for video game companies that are conducive to innovation and growth, helping to create jobs and revenue for local communities. Today's video game makers bolster the economy, strengthen our education system, inspire artistic expression, increase our chances for workplace success, and improve the delivery of healthcare. Increasingly, video games have proved to have a positive impact on these important issues, and as a result, we see a growing acceptance of games as more than just an entertainment medium. Policymakers, educators, healthcare providers, nonprofit organizations, and business leaders show a heightened understanding of the benefits of games and game technology in non-entertainment sectors. This, in turn, has led to increased interest in developing new and innovative applications for interactive entertainment software. There are countless examples of these trends, and the ESA is currently engaged in several partnerships intended to support and encourage this movement. Educators across the country increasingly incorporate games into their lesson plans. Middle schoolers and ninth graders and ninth grade teachers, for example, use iCivics to help teach civics lessons. And former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor collaborated with the Georgetown University Law School and Arizona State University to develop the online game-based learning platform. First launched in 2009, iCivics now features a series of games about constitutional law and the branches of U.S. government, each of which also comes with suggested lesson plans that are tailored to meet the state-specific learning standards. Most timely, iCivics launched Win the White House, a game that challenges players to run their own presidential campaign. And I don't know about you, from the look of the Republican primary, it doesn't seem like many of them have played the game. Games can be particularly useful in enhancing student interest and comprehension in science, technology, engineering, and math. A 2010 study by Information Technology and Innovation Foundation stated that video games are well-structured to be a learning experience, and that by developing strong motivation in learners, games can almost single-handedly transition a motivated casual gamer into a budding STEM professional. Educators are taking note of such studies and recognize the value of using interactive tools to teach these 21st century skills. For example, Tabula Digita's math program, Dimension M, challenges players to navigate virtual 3D environments and complete various missions by successfully solving math problems. The multiplayer games cover pre-algebra and algebra topics and provide students with an opportunity to practice concepts already learned in class. One study of Dimension M's impact on learning found that high school students who played the games scored significantly higher and demonstrated greater gains in their test scores from pre-test to post-test and on benchmark exams than their peers who did not play the game. The White House has also encouraged these trends through its Educate to Innovate campaign, and most recently by launching Digital Promise, a new national center dedicated to supporting the development of technologies such as educational games that can transform learning. The program will support research and development efforts to identify effective learning technologies, develop new approaches for rapid evaluation of new products, and explore ways to expand the market for learning software. Further demonstrating the White House's commitment to enhance STEM education through video games, President Obama recently appointed Dr. Constance Steinkuhler, an assistant professor of digital media at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as a senior policy analyst charged with researching and shaping policies around video games that improve education. Think of it, we now have a resident White House gamer-in-chief. In partnership with these White House initiatives, ESA is working with the Joan Ganz Cooney Center at Sesame Workshop, Eline Media, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to host the annual National STEM Video Game Challenge. This game design competition challenges developers to create games that generate interest and provide instruction in STEM topics. Just last month, President Obama invited a 2011 challenge winner from Mercer Island, Washington, to the White House Science Fair to show off Robot Commander, an educational video game that teaches players programming concepts as they guide a robot through a series of interactive mazes. We launched the second year of the competition in November, and the entry period will close later this week. The educational benefits of video games also extend into higher education. American colleges, universities, and technical schools offered 343 programs and courses in video game design, development, and programming during the current academic year. That includes 301 undergraduate programs and 42 graduate programs across 45 states. We release a list of each of these programs every year, and it's available on our website. Video games also continue to gain appreciation as works of art, as their stunning graphics and captivating soundtracks attract the art community's attention. ESA is partnering with the Smithsonian Institution to support and promote the American Art Museum's upcoming exhibit entitled The Art of Video Games. It will debut on March 16th. The exhibit will showcase the evolution of video games as an artistic medium with a focus on striking visual effects and the creative use of technologies. The museum will also go on tour to several sites across the country, including Boca Raton, Florida, Seattle, Washington, Yonkers, New York, Flint, Michigan, and Memphis, Tennessee. Soundtracks from popular video games are now providing the music for Video Games Live, a concert tour of top orchestras and choirs that include the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra and the London Philharmonic Orchestra. In addition, entertainment software influences the film industry, and the relationship between games and movies continues to expand. For example, the 2011 Tribeca Film Festival featured a special preview of Rockstar Games' L.A. Noire, and a panel discussion about the game's technology and narrative, marking the first time that this prestigious festival included a video game, something they probably learned from South by Southwest, who's included video games for over 10 years. More recently, the independent film Indie Game the Movie gained international attention at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival. The film follows three independent game designers at key moments in the game development process. As I'm sure many of you already have enjoyed, it was selected to be shown as a South by Southwest festival favorite this weekend. And finally, Uncharted 3 won a Best Writing Award from the Writers Guild of America. Now, in the business world, a variety of companies incorporate games into their employee recruitment and training programs. And according to a 2008 survey conducted by KRC Research, 70% of major employers utilize interactive software and games to train their employees. Those include UPS, Canon, USA, and IBM. The health community also uses games, game technologies, and virtual worlds to help diagnose patients, enhance treatments, and train tomorrow's healthcare providers. Hope Lab, a nonprofit group supported by the ESA Foundation, aims to improve the quality of life for kids with chronic illness. And they created a game called Remission, which has helped young cancer patients stick to their treatments more effectively and understand their disease. Most recently, video games helped accomplish a major breakthrough in the ongoing battle against AIDS. Using an online video game called Fold It, designed by Professor Zoran Popovich at the University of Washington, online gamers deciphered the protein that helps the HIV gene multiply. this protein had stumped scientists for over a decade, and gamers solved it in 10 days. A growing number of nonprofits and other organizations use games to raise awareness of key social issues. New York-based human rights organization Breakthrough launched a 12-week-long Facebook-based game last April called America 2049 to help inspire social change. The game combined elements of social gameplay, digital media, and real-life events to educate players on global issues, including discrimination, immigration, labor, and religious freedoms. Last year, the ESA Foundation, our industry's philanthropic arm, awarded a grant to Webwise Kids, an organization that has developed and distributed three educational computer games. They've delivered these games and made them available to students, teachers, law enforcement officers, and other youth leaders in 49 of the 50 U.S. states. Don't ask me which one the 50th is. I'm not sure. Missing is a game that educates youth about the dangers of online luring, predators in chat rooms. Mirror Image teaches about criminals who use the internet to lure young women with promises of modeling contracts and online romance. And Air Dogs shows teenagers that online crimes have lifelong legal and social consequences for teens and for their families. Now, a broadening cultural acceptance of games has also changed the definition of who is a gamer. The gamer audience has expanded, matured, and diversified greatly. Computer and video games are everywhere and played by nearly everyone. According to our 2011 Essential Facts about the computer and video game industry, 72% of American households play computer and video games, 82% of this population is adults, and the average age is 37 years old. That doesn't come as a surprise to everyone here at South by Southwest, but in Washington, when we talk about these things, they're stunned by that. 29% of game players are over the age of 50, and this is an increase from 9% in 1999. 42% of all gamers are women, and women over the age of 18 are one of the industry's fastest-growing demographics. In fact, women over the age of 18 represent a significantly greater portion of the game-playing population than boys age 17 and younger. Gameplay was once regarded as a solitary pastime, but has become an increasingly social activity over the past few years, especially when fueled by broadband and mobile devices, smartphones. Today, 65% of gamers play with other gamers in person at least 1 hour a week, an increase of 11% since 2006. In addition, 45% of parents report that they play with their children at least once a week. These statistics clearly demonstrate that video gameplay is widespread across a variety of demographic groups. Now, this tremendous growth and the diversification of the gamer audience has also transformed games from a diversion for the few into a mass medium. And that leads to strong, consistent demand for innovative products. And this demand and the success of our developers and publishers, many of which are represented here at South by Southwest, creating new gameplay experiences enables our industry to maintain its position as an economic powerhouse. According to the market research firm, the NPD Group, game industry sales generated approximately $25 billion in revenue in the United States in 2011. Now, that total includes digital and physical game formats, as well as sales of hardware and accessories. And also, according to recent analysis by NPD, the video game industry took 33% of the monthly consumer spend on entertainment, more than any other entertainment industry sector. Putting it plainly, when consumers are looking for entertainment, they are turning to video games more than anything else. And what's particularly compelling about this chart is think about the time allocated by consumers to each of those slices of the pie. And the time component for video games is significantly larger than what you see there. And our industry is delivering to consumers. Our industry's talented designers and programmers continually produce blockbuster titles that are quickly outselling other forms of entertainment. Last year, Activision Blizzard's Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 surpassed $1 billion in sales in 16 days. Those sales did not just shatter previous video game records, but also surpassed records for movie sales. Other best-selling games of 2011 include Warner Brothers' Batman Arkham City, which sold more than 2 million copies in its first week, and Bethesda Softworks' Elder Scrolls V Skyrim, which sold 3.5 million units in its first 48 hours on the market. And has also, incidentally, won two Game of the Year competitions within the industry, and that's just in the last month. The computer and video game industry is one of the most dynamic sectors of the U.S. economy. In fact, the entertainment software industry's revenue nearly doubled between 2006 and 2011, while the entire U.S. GDP only grew about 13% over that same time period. Further, computer and video games directly and indirectly employ over 120,000 people, including engineers, animators, graphic designers, musicians, and artists in 34 states. The average salary for direct employees is $90,000 a year, and these jobs are the embodiment of the 21st century digital creative economy, and they continue to grow. Here in Texas, for example, the Texas Film Commission reports that as of October 31st, video game productions that applied for incentives under the Texas Moving Image Industry Incentive Program had invested $156.5 million in the state and created nearly 1,700 new full-time jobs. That's over three times the activity of film and television combined. And we applaud the leadership of the Texas legislature, Governor Perry, and Texas Film Commissioner Evan Fitzmaurice for their vision and belief in our industry and that we would deliver on the jobs if the incentives were put in place. Our industry's innovations also drive trends in the way Americans play and interact. Right now, every product with a screen, whether it's a mobile phone, a PC, a tablet, a television, a handheld system, plays games and stimulates considerable consumer demand. Americans live life on the go, and consumers increasingly enjoy game content distributed in digital forms. NPD reported that the digital sales of the games and add-on digital content, along with spending on mobile and social games, game rentals, and subscriptions, rose 7% to over $7 billion last year. And that's approximately 29% of industry sales. And when I first came to South by Southwest 4 years ago, that number was $1 billion. So we're seeing very striking, very substantial growth, and you see it in the agenda of South by Southwest and in the excitement around those categories that are in the various panels. Among the top 10 paid apps on Apple's iTunes store, 7 are games. And 8 million iPad owners in the U.S. report using their device for gameplay. Our products also shape the consumption of other forms of media. Consider market analysis from BMO Capital Markets, which found a 36% increase in the number of installed HD video game consoles last year alone. Not only do these consoles provide gamers with a high-quality game experience, they also enable them to watch movies and TV shows when combined with services such as Hulu, Netflix, and ESPN. In fact, the Nielsen Company reported last summer that half of Netflix users connect to its streaming service through their consoles. Our industry is evolving and innovating and entertaining at a breakthrough pace. Whether it's new hardware, and this year you see the new Vita and the Wii U, as well as new Apple devices, whether it's new titles, which the world will see unveiled at E3 in June, or in the past 2 years, as our industry has developed the ability to reach scores of millions of consumers in the blink of an eye on any device, you see it happening in the mobile and social space at again, breakneck speed on virtually any platform. So games touch all areas of daily life, helping to shape and advance our society. Whether it's entertainment experiences or spectacular expressions of artistic vision, they are also tools for addressing what matters most to us. ESA is honored and privileged to represent the entertainment software industry during this transformative time. And I strongly believe that the protective force of the Supreme Court decision will promote further exploration of video game capabilities and benefits. And I'm confident that our industry is ready and able to capitalize on the opportunities it presents. As innovators, creators, entertainers, and content providers, we must all seize this moment. It is indeed our time. Great opportunity surrounds us, as seen by the vibrancy of the crowds here at South by Southwest. I wish all of the creators and innovators here at South by Southwest great success, and ESA looks forward to partnering with you now and in the very exciting years ahead. So I thank you for paying attention, and I look forward to your questions. If you could just, I don't know if you have to come to the microphone.
Well, can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
No, I'm curious, what are some of the legal challenges that you think will present a problem in the future?
And just if I could ask, when we ask a question, if you could just give your name briefly and then who you're with.
My name is Anika, and I'm a digital media producer.
Very good. Well, Anika, the speech that I gave in San Francisco, and I believe it's going to be, if it's not up on the website, it will be very imminently. We'll make sure of that. There are a wide range of challenges that we face as a legal matter, and it's because of the evolution of the industry to all these new business models. The old model, we had some predictable things that we had to deal with, unfortunately, including content at point of sale. That's now behind us. That's been replaced by a myriad e-commerce issues. I'll just tick off a few of them. First is you have things like privacy and data security. Last year, the industry was the victim of several hacks that came in from the outside, and some consumer data, obviously the companies had to respond. Well, we're now very much in that conversation on the legislation that's pending in Congress, being considered at the Department of Commerce at the White House. It's also very active with the Attorney General from California. So privacy and data security are vital. You have privacy disclosures. Where are the lines drawn about where we should be telling consumers about what they're consuming, how they're getting it, what's going to happen with their information, and what type of information is being collected? We, as an industry that's now digitally connected to everybody on the go, we have a duty to make sure we're being responsible about that. Now, we believe we are, but the government obviously is having a very extensive conversation. Another one, which is not immediately intuitive, is that there was a law passed by Congress last year that extended that said the Americans with Disabilities Act should be extended to communications technologies. The FCC was tasked with, or is tasked with, implementing that law and issued a series of rules and a process for applying for waivers for those technologies where the primary purpose of the device is not communication services. If you think about it, if you have a game console or a Vita or an iPad, the voice components for communication or the chat are incidental to gameplay. The primary purpose of those devices is to play games. The primary purpose of Angry Birds is to play a game. And if there is communication that goes on within that, it's incidental and should fall outside the reach of the accessibility by the disabled mandates, which would grind a significant amount of this creativity to a halt. It'd be very difficult to administer, and I guarantee you that the innovators that are here know nothing about this mandate. And for the government to implement it would be highly problematic. So we work on the pathway for waivers in that space. You also have taxation. You know, in Oklahoma, on the content-based space, there was a proposal to tax violent video games, in other words, those that were rated T and above in the eye of this legislator, again, fatally flawed and misleading, to tax violent video games to fund parks. Now, obviously, we don't support that. And then there are initiatives going on in several states that look at how do you tax digital goods? How do you tax goods that are bought and sold over the internet? That impacts this online capability that our industry has created. And somebody has to be at the table to negotiate on behalf of the innovators that are here, and that's the job that we are very excited to go after and uphold. So that's a flavor of some of the issues. I mean, again, there probably were a dozen to 15 that I highlight, including those. And I'm happy to visit with you at the break if there's a few more you'd like to talk about. Another question here?
Adult entertainment world, they filed mass copyright cases What's the video game?
And once more, if I could get your name and where you're from.
Mark Petrolis, Mud Mohawks.
Great. Mark, that's a very good question, and it's something that we've wrestled with, as I indicated in my remarks. This piracy threat, when I came to ESA almost 5 years ago, was a hard goods problem. It was discs that you could buy on the streets of foreign countries or even here in the United States, and it was modding or chipping boxes through hardware and then allowing then the ability to play a disc-based game in that fashion. It's now all online. And the online scale is it's much significantly higher. And as I indicated, it moved very quickly from physical goods to torrent files. Then it moved from torrent to these one-click hosts for streaming of the game content. And now the next evolution in the kindred cousins of today's form of piracy is hacking, consumer account fraud, and pirate servers. And it's a continuing threat that continues to evolve. And from where we are as ESA, we help our members understand where that's happening, how it's happening. We work with governments both here in the United States and around the world to help curb that threat. One of the unique things that we have as an industry is we have several members that say piracy is also known as distribution, that it's making it builds buzz and builds excitement, and they have a business model that's driven towards that, and they monetize their product through alternative means. We have other members that invest tens of millions of dollars in titles or billions of dollars in hardware consoles that say we have to have robust anti-piracy measures and systems and technology behind them that we can't have bypassed. And that's the business model that works for this part of the industry. And then you have a number of them that are in the middle that utilize both. And so what we have as a key advantage for us is interactivity. That interactive component where you have to go back to the server of the origin of the content owner or their licensee, that component right there makes it different because it's not a linear experience. If you click and you download a song, you have it all. You click and download a movie, it may take more time, but you get it all. With video games, you just get the beginning in most cases because the industry, again, has evolved to where the online gameplay is where so much of the value proposition is. So it's a very fluid environment that we navigate on behalf of our membership, but the key attributes are kind of genetic to the industry. Circle around what really makes us different than the other industries you mentioned is that interactive component. Another question? Well, we don't want to be excused so early, do we? Sure. Ivan, that's a great question. And in the issue of gambling and how to approach it is a very serious one for an industry that's built on a relationship of trust with principally parents, right? If you look at what it costs for a video game console and the broadband subscription and the plasma TV and all the cables and the games that are $50 to $60, that investment's real, very significant. And if you look at the PC-based experience, it's lower cost entry, but still there are these relationships which parents are principally in charge of creating and managing. We have a duty to make sure that whatever path the industry goes down relative to gambling is one that's administered in a very responsible way. And I think that there is active consideration by a number of companies to explore that. It's the regulations around gambling are quite Byzantine. And in many cases, it's state by state. So this will not be something that's released in one fell swoop and moves like you won't have Gamblingville. It's not going to be like that. That model won't work. Instead, there are going to be way too many other rules and requirements that are going to have to be complied with, or people are going to go to jail. And for us as an industry, we need to make sure that whatever path we take when it comes to the opportunity or the risk or the challenge presented by gambling is that we're remaining true to the core of that trust relationship we have that currently today is a $25 billion domestic U.S. industry that's growing. Another question?
Anika?
Yeah.
Back to the legal challenges. Are there other challenges that are relating to other businesses and other industries that you think will have implications for gaming? Because you mentioned a lot of the hacking, which would apply to most online mm-hmm. shopping and other things, but I'm curious if there are other rulings or other cases pending that you think could have a wide-reaching implication.
I would say, you know, on the privacy side, there are definitely, there are multiple initiatives going on. Both in Congress, you have privacy legislation. You have the Department of Commerce, which is issued at the behest of the White House, with the direction of the White House, a framework for how to approach that, including a collaborative process where industries would come in and set forth a series of best practices with the idea that the Federal Trade Commission would then codify those essentially and say that's a safe harbor. If you behave within that, then you're fine. If you don't, then you're not. We have very different approaches to privacy than other industries do, but we are implicated, right? There's financial data, there's personal data, and that's important. I would say also that the FTC is looking at COPPA, which is the Child Online Protection Act, I believe is what it stands for. And they've received comments, and we're expecting more guidance from them. But for the first time since 2000, they're relooking the COPPA rules, and those are the rules that apply to those that work with or interact with children online. What information are you gathering, and how are you retaining it, and do you have the consent of the parents and the children for the gathering of that data? If that's extended to include things like gamer tags, and specific identifying information about devices, that actually is very harmful to the industry and is difficult. I'll give you another example is on the international side. In Korea, they have two different statutes which are in force or about to be in force in Korea that we have offered guidance from the United States industry perspective that we think are the wrong approach. One of them says you have to have an automatic shutdown. The kids under 16 are not allowed to play video games between midnight and 6 a.m. It's against the law in Korea to do that. That presents lots of complications for those that provide services from here or from abroad, from any country, to those customers. How do you know they're a kid and all of that? It's a very difficult thing to administer. The other law says that it's called the GIPA, and it requires the affirmative consent of both the parents and any person under the age of 18 for providing online gaming services, and sets up some rules around that. Again, very challenging, and it makes it a significant obstacle to the uptake of games. I don't know how many of you have teenagers, but they're moving at a pace here in the U.S. much faster than their parents when it comes to understanding what's fun or cool. And it would make that experience very, very problematic as an economic matter, as a law enforcement matter, and as a company and an innovator, make it very difficult here in the U.S. So those are some additional examples, some of which impact us directly, others where we're part of a larger debate but have a very unique perspective. Another question? Comment? Anything? Right here? Yeah. Interesting. That's a great question. I literally I enjoy that one because we haven't had any media in the room, right? My favorite opinion in the case, and I say this facetiously for those that are recording it, is Justice Thomas's opinion, because Justice Thomas took the view that he dissented from the majority opinion because commercial entities, he says, have no right to speak to my children because I own my children. And you have no right. And my daughter's over here. Alexandria is right here. I'm particularly fond of it. It was not very popular in my house. I like the decision. But it essentially says, I am the keeper of the speech rights of my child. You have no right to speak to my child in any way, including through violence. And that was the thrust of his dissent. And then the other dissent was a catalog that was put together by Justice Breyer, I believe, right? Was the dissenter. And it was his own catalog of all of the content that he found offensive. He has an appendix to the decision of all the things that he found offensive. And that was the thrust of that dissent, was that this speech is not worthy of protection because of all of this activity that goes on within it. And you could imagine what that list would look like for motion pictures or for cable TV or music or books. And instead, it was very focused on us and said that our content was offensive. So those were the two dissents.
Justice Thomas has interesting First Amendment.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does. Sometimes you get those quirks, but you know, from our perspective, it's how do you count to five? That was how your advocacy is. It's a very simple thing when you think about it, but you must get to five, and and you have nine different audiences that you're appealing to. And I was at the oral arguments, and each of the questions that came from Justice Thomas asked no questions. He never does. He's never asked one from the bench in all of his years on the court. Makes it difficult to read where he is. But you're trying to set up your case to get to five. Now, we were delighted to have a margin of two extras, but it really is about a race to five. And we thought we would get him. We thought that he would, because of his views in other similar cases, but he went down one of those paths that was less predictable. Back to Anika.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to be the game?
That's a great question, and here's just some thoughts about that. Is, you know, privacy, location data is just one form of data that's captured. It's not captured by everyone because not everyone is on mobile. I think that the console makers probably have a pretty good idea where your Xbox is,
right,
or your PlayStation or your Wii, for those that are here from all disciplines. And so I think it's much more in the mobile space where it gets tricky. And then does this phone belong to a minor or does it belong to an adult? And you don't know these days. It used to be these devices were so expensive, only adults had them. Now, I mean, they're marching right down that age path. And you've got, I've seen kids in, you know, where I live in Northern Virginia, probably as young as 8 years old, carrying around an iPhone. So it gets more complicated when you deal with, so you have a bifurcation there. And it's going to be very, very interesting how we manage that. And right now, for that to be a critical issue for the industry, location has to be part of the game experience. That's what would make it have the most attractiveness, where you would see more of it happening. And then, obviously, as it starts to take on broader appeal in society, the interest or concern goes up by government. Right now, we're at the low levels of that type of gaming happening. There is a game in Japan, which is exactly the opposite, called Monster Hunter. It's made by Capcom. And it is an intensely huge favorite in Japan. It's not very popular here, but it is very popular in Japan. And it is a location-based game. You actually, your location triggers most of the gameplay. And I'm not familiar with how they deal with it in Japan. But that's just a thought on that particular aspect. Another question? Anybody want to go to E3? You sat through this today. We could sign you up, get you an invite to E3. That's what we'll do next year. We'll say we'll have a lottery for E3 passes, and we'll probably pack the place. Any questions about anything? Here, sure.
I'm involved in educational titles, and right now there's a big push for educational teaching materials to go digital. Any point of views as far as homeschooling? How is that going to be more state level, federal level, or is there, as we push towards getting rid of textbooks and more digital devices moving into schools and homeschooling?
I mean, you touched on a great point and something I spent some time on in the remarks, and I'm going to cue Eric here that when I'm done, you're up, because Eric dedicates probably a quarter of his life to this subject, so I'll speak and then let him add to it. What's happening right now is you have a realization happening. Well, step back a little bit. There are forces for change within the education community that are led by technology, and it's companies like Intel, Cisco, Google, Microsoft, and others. They are the outsiders in the education debate. They are the ones who are seen as being a threat by the core education community that's been doing things in such the same way. And Eric, I'm going to let you have your analogy that you like to use, and I'll let you use it. But it's just safe to say the rest of the world's moved in a different direction, but our educational tools have not. So that group is galvanized. Second is you have some acceptance by a larger number of teachers that, one, the system is not working, and we're not generating the level, especially STEM education, that we need. And two, you know what? We think video games could help. They're having a hard time keeping the attention of their students. All you have to do is hold up a 3DS or a Vita, and the kids' eyes will track like this when you move it. I mean, they're riveted to those devices. And what they want to do more than anything else is make games. And if you can harness that enthusiasm to make games, to keep them on that path, there is a realization by a growing part of the education community, which includes the White House, It includes great partners like I listed, and this is the Joan Ganz Cooney Center or Sesame Street. For those of you that aren't familiar, Joan Ganz Cooney had this bold thought in the late 60s that a modern technology that was seen as being a wasteland could be used for education. And that technology was television. And so Joan Ganz Cooney said, we can create compelling content that will teach, and that's Sesame Street. A few years ago, probably about 4 years ago, they published a paper that said there is a new technology which is seen as being a wasteland, which can drive education forward, and it's video games. And we've partnered very effectively through Eric's efforts with them and done a number of things, including the partnerships that I outlined. So we have engagement from the White House. We've got an accepting group from within the education community. And what we're getting really close to get to your answer is actual tools that teach that are video game and interactive based. And the one example I gave you, Dimension M, I believe is the name of it, that game is one example. We're going to have more of them. And that is exciting because what's going to make this really jump is when you have it work, when you have objective proof that says kids test better, kids perform better, kids learn better using these other tools. But what's unfortunate from, I think, the perspective of your question is homeschooling could be a little further out. It's got to be proved in the classroom first, because this flywheel that drives education is state government spending, and that's got to catch it first. And then there'll be an ability, I'm sure, for that type of tool to be made available for use in the home. So those are my thoughts, but I'll turn to Eric and let you add on that, Eric. So. Yeah, and since we're having a conversation here, we're also coming to the close. I mean, Katie, do you want to take that question? I mean, since you're living it. And just to explain, I mean, there is a pioneer in teaching through video games. There's one, and it's her. So why don't you explain?
Involved, and there's an interesting thing.
Yeah, and it is true that because we had one of the 286 computers, was one of our first computers we brought home. First thing we got, besides like some word processing software, which was pretty crude at the time, we got some games for the kids, like Math Blaster and Mavis Bacon Teaches Typing. And Alex was very young at the time. She's a junior here, engineering student at UT right now. And she pretty much turned her nose at it pretty quickly because that's just called homework. It needs to be gameplay that's compelling, and then they learn within that, and then you get the results that everybody's looking for here. So very good question, and they had multiple folks in the room that knew about it. So now we have time for one more because we don't want to go over time. We have 4 more minutes, so is there another question that someone has or comment?
Anika? No one else does. I don't know. But I was just curious. So we were talking yesterday about hardcore versus casual gaming and the notion of like the barrier to entry being lower, that a lot of new people are introduced to gaming because the platforms are cheaper than buying an actual console box. You can game on a number of different things. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on in terms of education, because, you know, from, I think, traditional thinking, a lot of video game consoles, a lot of computers and other things are not affordable for a poorer family, and if education moves that way, then what do you do? Do you think that with, you know, changes in technology, it becomes more accessible to a less economically, you know, prosperous individual?
That's a very good question, and I think one way to look at it is you have to have multiple tools depending on the resources of the school system or the school itself. You hear about some of these schools where every kid has an iPad. I'll tell you what, it's not where my kids are going to school. And I don't know that there's a public school that's doing that. But if they have that, they're on the bleeding edge, or on the leading edge, and it's proven to be effective and useful. Maybe it lightens the backpack too. Then that type of technology in the classroom, whether it's an iPad or whether it's an Xbox, makes a lot of sense. And we need to break down the barriers, if there are any, on the purchasing level, the GSA-approved list for schools, to include those devices if, in fact, they are compelling for education, because you prove the case in wherever classroom you're in. I mean, let's just prove the concept, and then things will kind of take care of themselves, because there are so much money on the sidelines in education that would like to do something impactful. And if there was a way that said these devices work, I'm confident there would be funding that would come in behind it, and people would prove that concept. Then you kind of shame the rest of the system into upgrading. So some of these things are going to take some time, because those with more resources will need to lead. But the PC is a pretty powerful tool, and browser-based applications can be very powerful as well, as long as the gameplay is compelling. So it's more the software piece today, and we'll work on the devices later, but the price of the devices are coming down too. If you look at the consoles, they're now down where they're pretty affordable, and what evidently in history says they hit $200 and then everybody's got one. Literally, your penetration goes to 100%. That's pretty helpful for the homework aspect of it. Boys and girls clubs and after school organizations are another good place to go to have that capability there. So there are things within our grasp that we can do relatively immediately with compelling content. Is Katie, is that close?
Talk about the console or the iPad. But definitely the price point around tablets is allowing
Well, and with that, I'm getting the sign from the back of the room that we have our time has expired. I would like to thank you all for coming and being patient and for your engagement. It's been a delightful hour, and look forward to seeing you around and wish you a great South by Southwest. I hope that the rest of your experience here is terrific, but thank you. Well done.